Welcome, dear listener, to this episode of the Demokratza podcast. In this episode, the Bernese poet and theater professional Raphael Urweider speaks with the Palestinian author Adania Shibli about the invention of nations, nationalism, the digital age, democracy, and the importance of contemporary literature for our understanding of community.
I'm very glad and happy that you first will read a more or less theoretical text about the, let's say, invention of nations, or maybe the absurdity of nations, and later we can take this text as a starting point for the discussion.
Yes, I just also would like to say maybe a few words about this text that I'm going to read and why I wrote it or how I came to write it. I think the question of nation state is something that is haunting, especially for me coming from Palestine, where one seeking to consider this idea of nationalism and the mal effects of nationalism. I think there you start to think, because we're still thinking about a way to how to be together. Is nationalism the frame that can lead us into a better way of life, and especially seeing with Israeli nationalism and the effect of that on the life of Palestinians? So I think these kind of questions have been there all of my life, but not only me, of many people, I think. And also getting to understand history and maybe seeing how nationalism actually created more crimes in the name of togetherness than rather trying to include everybody. And this is, I think, the time when I came across that novels and writing and literature had a role in kind of forming the nation state. And I came to think, okay, but this was in the 19th century and 20th century. What about writing today? And there I share some of these reflections, which I put them in a paper because it's easier, I think, not to be lost in there many things. And I know it's not a funny text, so I was sort of like, and by the afternoon, well, I was completely ashamed, thinking I'm with Raphael, the funniest person I've met, and I'm going to read this very serious text. So I leave the fun part for Raphael. I'm going to take the heavy part.
Demokratia.
Some of us, at least once in their lifetime, have entertained the question, what if someone from the past suddenly came back to life and saw the way we live today? This hypothetical time traveler does not need to emerge from epochs so distant in the past. It is enough to assume he or she lived in the 19th century for us to envision the astonishment on their faces as a result of how unimaginable our present life is for them. And we may think at first that the reasons behind their astonishment are related to the cars running in the streets and planes crossing the sky, people speaking in their mobile phones. However, these are probably not the only details that will surprise those who lived 200 years ago. There might be another source for their astonishment: the composition of today's societies as opposed to theirs, where different ethnicities and languages can be encountered on a daily basis in the streets of many of our cities. This last element in our little game of imagination prompts actually a number of questions. What does the composition of contemporary societies in Western Europe tell us about the 19th century idea of the nation that many still rely on to frame their shared lived experience? Should our perception of ourselves as nationals of one community shift, now that this idea does not reflect the realities of our lives, nor account for our interconnectedness in the aftermath of the digital revolution? I'm posing these questions while having in mind Benedict Anderson's book, Imagined Communities, written in 1983. Anderson's main argument there is that the concept of nation is a cultural artifact which came into being in late 18th century as a distillation of complex historical forces. But given that the members of even the smallest nation will never know most of their fellow members, the nation, according to Anderson, is essentially imagined. One of the main historical forces that played a role in this process of imagining the nation was printing, which is an outcome of the First Industrial Revolution, coupled with the emergence of the novel as a literary form. In its beginnings, the printing industry had focused on publishing in Latin. After the saturation of the Latin readers' market, printers, searching for new sources of profit, started to publish in vernaculars, also novels. This soon consolidated the speakers and readers of various major vernaculars in separate groups. Additionally, printing drastically slowed down changes in vernaculars as it maintained the cohesion of their users into distinct communities and created consciousness of the membership of their speakers. But another major effect related specifically to the appearance of novels in vernaculars was the introduction of the experience of a meanwhile that is shared by a certain community. To explain what he means by this experience of a meanwhile, Anderson cites the novel Noli Mi Tangere, translated as Touch Me Not, published in 1887 by José Rizal, one of the founders of Filipino nationalism. The novel follows a man and his fiancée as they move alongside other characters simultaneously in a calendrical time, which is the meanwhile, through a landscape that fuses the world inside the novel with that outside it. Yet not of the entire world, but the specific world of Manila, which is familiar to the readers. In this way, Rizal's novel draws a national landscape that has fixed and clear borders and is populated by a specific society or a nation that is moving in time, sharing the present while advancing together from past into future. The recognition of a landscape and familiarity with it and those inhabiting it was, according to Anderson, supported as well by railway networks, another outcome of the Industrial Revolution. Railways had many people, rather than a small elite, move outside their own villages or towns, realizing the simultaneous existence of others in the national landscape inside which they are moving. Just as the 19th century novel assisted readers in realizing the kind of communities they are living in and identifying them as their nations, an increasing number of novels written in recent years can help us recognize the type of societies or communities we are part of. As an example, I would like to recall Merle Kruger's Havari, published in 2015, which depicts the meeting of various protagonists with different nationalities in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a German novelist. The story is inspired by a 3-minute YouTube clip shot in September 2012 with a smartphone by Terry Diamond, a resident of Belfast, on board a Caribbean ship cruising the Mediterranean. The clip depicts a small rubber boat carrying refugees floating somewhere near the Spanish coast. Intertwined in the narrative are testimonies by relevant characters with various nationalities, Irish, Algerian, Filipino, Ukrainian, and Spanish, all of whom had some role in the incident at the center of the book. Another contemporary interesting novel in this respect is Rana Dasgupta's Tokyo Cancelled, published in 2005, which involves 13 protagonists from different parts of the world stranded in one of Tokyo's main airports. Or Kimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Americana, published in 2013, whose protagonists move between Nigeria, the US, and Britain. In these novels, the protagonist movement is not confined to one defined national landscape, common to novels from the 19th century, such as Noli Mi Tangere. They also do not revolve around one specific national group. rather, different nationalities can be encountered in one specific location. The protagonists as well are able to move outside their national landscapes, not only physically, but using planes, and ships, but also virtually, with the help of new digital media, such as mobile phones and the internet. In brief, the situations depicted in these novels are not unusual, nor alien to the general public of readers and their experiences nowadays. Physical mobility has indeed drastically increased in the last couple of decades, with travel becoming more affordable, allowing many people rather than a limited few to arrive to new places. In other cases, people opted for physical mobility to escape wars and natural and human-made disasters. Most of us are able to move physically, but especially virtually, beyond our defined national borders far more than 200 years ago. The digital revolution that has marked the last two decades has helped forge social connections that could not have been envisioned before. Nowadays, for example, smartphones are not merely used by an elite to run their businesses from afar as it was the case 30 years ago, but also by refugees who rely on smartphones to navigate their ways to safety. This, to a great extent, explains the increasing number of people relocating to places other than their birth countries. While it is repeatedly mentioned that around 1 million people arrived in 2015 to resettle in Germany, for instance, there are about 3.5 million Germans living outside Germany. Researchers predict that the number of immigrants living in Europe within the next 3.5 decades will reach more than 400 million. Probably a high number of Europeans will also be leaving their national homes to live elsewhere. Under such circumstances, we have no option but to start reconsidering our reliance on nationalism as a framework to define our shared lived experience, and think about alternative frames that can better reflect the composition of communities we are part of today, physically and even virtually. Sticking to the 19th century model of togetherness and belonging in the form of the nation-state continues to prove to be disastrous in the 21st century as it was already in the 20th century. Many European cities today include second and third generation of hundreds of thousands of migrant workers who left their home countries in the 50s and the 60s to work in various countries in Europe and contribute to rebuilding them and their economy in the aftermath of the Second World War. However, the notion of national identity remained hardly challenged as a reference point for claiming kinship in these societies. This left most of the discussion around belonging to a community limited to questions of integration and assimilation into the culture of the majority. In doing so, certain social and cultural practices are being privileged over others, instead of valuing the asset of the many varied singularities. Instead, the pattern of inclusion-exclusion, typical in this case, emerged. And the ills of this pattern are visible in Europe today more than any time in the last 5 decades, manifest in the form of severe social and political backlashes. Some can be traced in the rise of national right-wing extremist movements that seem to be more and more appealing to the political and social mainstream. Others emerge in the form of religious extremism, which has attracted members of communities with non-European ethnic backgrounds, especially young generations that are experiencing inequality routinely on many levels, residence, education, work opportunities, etc. By repeatedly outlining religion as a main reason for their difference and their exclusion, some of these young men and women sought a sense of communal kinship within the frame of Islam, for example, which, like many other religions, overlooks nationality. In the ranks of ISIS in Syria, one finds a community that is formed by nationals of many different countries who, upon returning to their national home, they often do so only to destroy it, like in Greek tragedies. As such, rather than simply search for explanations in religions, in this case, Islam, for the behavior of these young men and women, one ought to address their behavior as an outcome and a failure to imagine a community where everyone is an integral part of it. abandoning the social frame of majority versus minority communities and cultures as the only one we can opt for today certainly will only lead to less tragedies rather than more. A possible way to achieve this by imagining communities that consider differences based on race, language, sexuality, religion, cultural practices as essential to their well-being instead of considering them a threat. With people's movements only to increase, we cannot postpone imagining such communities, which some contemporary novels already started to do. We need to imagine communities that allow the possibility of shifting choices and other offer fluidity for self-identification within their structures, akin to virtual communities, where one can join or leave them without the repercussions of alienation and coerced sense of belonging. If we continue to refuse acknowledging such major technological and social shifts and insist on an old imagined versions of societies, we would not be positioned to experience a future that is less violent and unjust. The novel and literature as a whole can certainly have a major role in this task of imagining, even foretelling a form of togetherness that is most attuned with our inner disdain to social alienation.
Thank you very much.
I think there are too many ideas and things, but it's your job now to...
Well, it also gives me a lot of ideas. Maybe it's not. Maybe we can just talk about a few aspects of this idea. What fascinates me, or what came to my mind, is that there are some kind of almost at the moment two kinds of nationalism. There's the nationalism that is conservative and exclusive and based on an idea that we should somehow save a country from changing too much, or save the country from foreigners. And then there's the nationalism of people who don't have a country, which Kurds or people who live, for instance, or Catalans who live in Spain and want their own country. And I wonder how you see the difference between these two kinds of, or is there a difference in these kinds of nationalisms, or should they all be abandoned?
Well, you know, this brings us actually back to the question of also the nationalism that came, you know, as a result of struggles against colonialism, because there also the nationalism came as if the only way to claim freedom. And I think this is, we can see it also in the Catalan case, the Kurdish, or even the Palestinian case. But I think this is here, it's not like something that comes with a lot of thinking. It's almost what is ready there, and it seemed to, or we think it worked somewhere there, and we want it, because it's the only frame that offers us a sense of equality and freedom. And I think this is the tricky part, because it is not, and we can see from history that whenever nationalism is there, it created wars and exclusion. That is a very violent act. So therefore, I know that many would come to see this idea of nationalism as emancipatory, as something that will eliminate the oppression of another group, because, you know, nationalism says if I'm recognized as somebody who has a national identity, so my national identity is equal to yours. Mm-hmm. But the thing, I think nationalism doesn't create this, that we're all equal as nationals of different communities, but we are always special. We need you to differentiate ourselves from each other. And I think here there's already antagonism in this. Mm-hmm. In the term itself, that does not allow it to be really emancipatory.
Yeah, and as you said also, that the freedom movement in the 60s in Africa on the continent was, one was a Pan-African movement and the other one was in a way nationalism. And the big tragedy is that the Pan-Africanism was never successful in a way because of the idea of nations, and the tragedy, the second tragedy, is that the nations were never nations before colonialism, and that's still, I think, maybe one of the main reasons why the continent is not evolving in a way.
Yeah, and you have lots of struggles between different groups, between different ethnic groups, and what do you do with different languages? And maybe my really concern is also the elimination of different languages. Mm-hmm. I think I'm biased in that sense because of my love to language, like how we can come to eliminate one language from a life of somebody, and why the feeling threatened by the presence of another language in our life. I know it is connected to the idea that we cannot understand, but this understanding is not even available when we speak the same language. Even, you know, between two lovers, there's no understanding who live in the same place, speak the same language. So it cannot be in that sense like it is the fault of language. And I think nationalism really relied a lot on kind of bringing some people together while excluding others, which is a model that cannot work in the African continent with the presence sometimes of 80 languages. Mm. Or for instance, in Indonesia, where you have more than 200 languages. Mm-hmm. And so there is a power relations, like which language we're going to privilege over the other. And there's the problematic starts because somebody feels they don't have a place.
Yeah, that's one problem. And the problem is that, somehow there's always a big confusion with nation, ethnicity, language, people. Because, I read interviews with very, let's say, intelligent Jewish historians who say things like every people in the world should have a nation, you know. And then I was like, yeah, but a people, even the word people as a Volk in German is a very strange concept that also originates from a time, but we always act as if these words actually mean something, you know, that ethnicity, maybe religion should be a reason, every religion could have a country, but then we all would live somewhere else.
Yeah, and this whole discussion about religions, like it's also how it's coming back to differentiate people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it might be, for instance, we take the case of Islam. I remember a time the question was if you're an atheist or religious. Mm-hmm. But I think after the Gulf War, the 2003 Gulf War, people started to speak not if you're a religious or an atheist, but if you're Sunnah and Shia, whereas here it is like, you know, Islam as a whole, and within the Shia it's something else. So you see this constant need. I think it's very interesting, this kind of habit to find difference as a way to define ourselves. And I think this has not been always the case. There are examples in history of a different type of being together. I don't think it is better. We don't know. I mean, living a tribal life, did it create harmonious communities? But at least we know that societies lived with less crimes, like massive crimes. I mean, the massive crimes we see because of nationalism, they are unparalleled in a way. So we should consider different ways. And I think exactly as you say about language, because language is important, and important to understand words are receiving their meaning by use. So people would mean something maybe now, but meant something 200 years ago. And we can also imagine what it can mean in the next 200 years and after 200 years.
Yeah, and I think that I mean, Switzerland, almost every nation in Europe has a lot of different languages, but we always pretend that in France they speak French or in Germany it's German. But if you look at the actual people who lived there, also historically, there was never a country that only spoke one language, but it's somehow ingrained in our idea that a language and a country should be the same. And this is another, even in Germany you have, Germany is one of the maybe younger nations even that exists compared to France or Great Britain. And even within German you have so many dialects and sociolects that are highly different from each other and could be actually used to be countries. You know, Bavaria has nothing to do with Hamburg, for instance, but then suddenly there were these movements that said or people created songs like Germany above all. It didn't mean Germany above all the other countries, but it meant Germany above all the countries within Germany. So it was a unifying song for Germans, but was then misinterpreted as Germans are the best in the world, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting what you bring also about Switzerland. Probably you know better, because it's a good example of polyphony, or knowing more than one language, can actually be a place where people can share and live together somehow under one frame. And imagine, like, if each country says, okay, we're gonna follow the Swiss example also.
A coalition of the willing, more or less.
Yeah. We have four official languages, but I think this is being threatened. Although, you know, like you're saying this comment, like going back to think about nationalism, maybe it did offer at a certain point a bigger frame. Because, you know, before you had a smaller group speaking these different dialects or languages, then unified in one language, the German language of Hochdeutsch or the French, but there is violence in that act. Mm-hmm. There's a violence of elimination. True, it made bigger group of people come together and identify as a bigger group, like 80 million, which is something has not been before. But then, what do we do with the violence that is there? And this is my question, actually, as always. And it's very important also, I want, because when I was reading, as if it came, I want to use the novel to create this space. And I'm not saying that, because I don't relate to literature as a tool or as an instrument to promote a certain idea. But what I'm trying to look for in the novel, a certain sensibility that can guide us in imagining how we can be together away from the idea of the nation state.
Because your text starts with a fantasy that is not possible in reality, that someone comes from 200 years ago and suddenly lands here. That's already a novel in a way, or an idea for a novel. I think the fact that literature, unlike other ways of expression, can fantasize about worlds that don't exist should also be maybe a helpful way of thinking or rethinking or new communities or new possibilities, how people can interact with each other. For me, one other question that I had or came up is the exclusion-inclusion model of a nation unfortunately works also in other kinds of frames. In a way, as you said, or the novels you quoted, you have a virtual society in an airport, which is only accessible for people who have the means and possibilities to fly.
Yeah.
Then you have a cruise ship, which is also not a cheap way of traveling. Yeah. And you have the virtual world, or which is also you need electricity, you need a computer or a phone to be part of a virtual community online. And this also for me, I mean, is a model of let's say, yeah, there's people from 30 different nations are together, but still the status and class of the people yeah. is then another way of defining who belongs to the community and who not.
Yes, way, I mean, certainly, yeah. because, you know, although on the ship there would be the workers and the airports, there are the cleaners who we don't see, the security people who come from certain classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's these encounters. But I think the problematic is not in forming the groups. For me, I find personally, but the exclusion, mm-hmm. the violent exclusion of others. Mm-hmm. The minute that there is an openness in a group, if they constantly form and reform without rejecting other forms of being or saying this is how it should be and this is the only legitimate group to exist, mm-hmm. I think this is problematic. And probably we are seeing it now with kind of certain virtual communities. And it's very interesting, like how people on virtual spaces, if they are only interested in something, they come together and they can leave. And I'm really thinking, what does this mean? Does this mean limiting our world to only the people we are kind of thinking in a similar way to them? And it's very interesting because also sometimes, you know, I go to the U.S. and I think, wow, the U.S. is the most revolutionary place. It's so leftist and radical. And of course, because I'm just hanging around with these circles and the yeah. same as Switzerland. Switzerland is like, you know, the anarchist place. You know?
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it's something to think about, like how much we are coming across people and being intimate with them who don't necessarily believe or live the way we live or hold yeah. the same ideas. In a novel, it's possible. And I think in that way, maybe novels are more interesting to imagine these different groups. And
yeah, and there's not a lot of novels also that actually are national novels, you know. I think world literature always happens in small places, actually. Mm-hmm. Even Wilhelm Tell wasn't written about Switzerland, it was written about a few little ridiculous villages around the lake somewhere. And the nation building that Wilhelm Tell later did had nothing to do with the actual story that was told in the novel. Or if you look at, Nobel Prize winning literature from the United States often focuses on one village or on one family, one tragedy, or even Shakespeare often had. Stories about you. The thing maybe I want to say is that literature often then is used as a tool for whatever goal a nation or a politics has, but it's not the literature that formed it in
yes.
a way.
Yes, yeah. Yes, certainly. And then it's also, we can...
It's like the Bible or the Quran. You
yeah.
can also use
yeah,
it for anything.
Yeah, you can
anything.
Use any yeah. text, exactly. And you can take any word and use it and turn it into something else. And so I think it's interesting to see that as a source of, other possibilities, like life is not close to this one possibility. And of course, there's always the attempt to say this is the national writer, which is almost like this kind of cultural artifact and like the national museum and all these national elements that they can bring somebody. It's almost like you feel this is the idea, this is maybe the Swiss or the Egyptian writer, the national writer, like Najib Mahfouz or whoever else. But at the same time, when you read these works, wherever you are, regardless of the history you had or future that is awaiting you, you would feel this book so close to you. Mm-hmm. You are part of it. And that's why we cannot limit literature to that. And I think it's important to remember that as well. That
literature in a way is timeless through that, and it's local, but through being local, it has the possibility of being very specific and unspecific at the same time, enough to invite all people to understand the story.
And we, as readers, we bring our own kind of understanding to that, because you know a work of literature is really complete within this relationship of the written text, the reading, and the writing of it.
Yeah. The other thing that came to my mind is you speak about the digitalization and how it would be nice to join a country like a chat room almost, or be part of. I mean, the idea of nations maybe also had to do with the Industrial Revolution, and because the industry also needed bigger entities to be able to function. The beginning of capitalism was not possible with many small countries with their own money and their own whatever system, metric systems, and I think the nation building had to do with also with economic reasons.
Of course, it is the main thing, you know, like you know how we're going to arrange a new identity of these workers who move to the cities to work in the factories. It's no longer the village and the rural life that gives you meaning. You have to have a new definition of the self. And I think, like, you know, there is, I'm not proposing that we will find our kind of future community of being together in a virtual space, but I'm saying that virtual space is actually undermining this idea of fixed, clear borders, of national borders. And you see it, for instance, with the extreme right-wing movements, how much connection they have all over the world. And so it's interesting.
Nationalists of all countries unite.
Yes, exactly. And it's very kind of intriguing, because the idea of extreme national right-wing movements, it is about nationalism, but they are going to the almost the anti-national frame to work. And you see it with the French, Dutch, German, kind of Italian, these summits that they had a couple of years ago and last year, and constantly, and youth movements are meeting. And okay, so how we cannot let that slip in a way, this possibility to be appropriated for further violence rather than.
This is, I think, the particularization that happens also through social media and online possibilities. I mean, people moved to Switzerland, maybe from Italy in the 60s, they were somehow forced to join Swiss community because they didn't have the possibility to listen to Italian radio or watch Italian TV or read. I mean, they could read a few Italian newspapers, but most people were forced to be Swiss in a way. And now you can, now everybody from any nation can actually almost be part of the nation they came from while living somewhere else. They can buy the food from where they came from, they can have the music, the culture, whatever, online.
And read the news as well,
And are in a way staying in a different bubble, and the connection to where they actually live is only through a few things like the job, maybe, or school and things like that. And I think this particularization is, in a way, good and necessary, but it's also then, for me, begs the question, what is then a community if it if it only contains bubbles, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And also we cannot ignore the sense of isolation for these people. Like, you cannot have a coherent emotional connection only based on the virtual, because you're not active. You're almost like a receiver, a customer. Mm-hmm. Of that. You're not an active member forming this. And I think it's very important to see each one's potential as a human being and contributing to this idea of togetherness, of our sense of shared life and shared concerns. And how are we, like, so how are we concerned now? And you see it, for instance, with disasters. For instance, a disaster happens, and for example, the biggest was the tsunami a few years ago. And it was amazing to see that the coverage was almost, because I was studying media, and I was seeing, like, almost every newspaper in different parts of the world were putting how many of their nationals got killed. And
yeah, yeah.
And so we are using this kind of nationalism to care about some and not to care about others. And I think this is maybe probably what bothers me as a person, as a somebody who would like to be and contribute to you know, the world we are living in, not only the humans, but also, you know, nature. And
empathy has a kilometer range, actually.
So you think nationalism is just protecting our sense that we are not overwhelmed emotionally?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the problem is also that the step from nationalism to dehumanizing people who are not from the same nation or the same skin color or whatever is very small and is very fast.
Yeah.
And I think dehumanization of other human beings is maybe what the 20th century was all about. In a way.
Actually, there's a couple of two Nigerian friend writers, and they were telling me, they were describing some of the tensions or also massacres that occurred in Nigeria between different ethnicities. And the same thing happened in Rwanda. People kill their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
You kill the closest to you that have the little difference. It's not, you don't go and in a civil war, you don't go and kill somebody you don't know, but you know them. So it's very strange, this, how we rely on this kind of little difference, as you say, of different ethnicity or language or practices to slip into justifying that they shouldn't be alive or shouldn't enjoy what we enjoy.
Yeah, another confusion that exists is often, I think, the idea of, let's say, democracy and capitalism in a nation, you know, that, or for a long time we grew up with the idea that somehow capitalism and democracy is one package that you sell all over the planet, and that one doesn't exist without the other, you know, in a way. And
with that, the idea of a state.
Of a state, exactly. For me, then the question, when we would now come up with a model how the world could be reorganized without nations, for me then the question gets vital. What is then governance?
Yeah.
What is a possibility to govern? What is a? How would a democracy look like? Is it then the country Google against the country Apple, or you know, how would that look like?
I mean, this is also, the form of governance that we are experiencing now and the sense of equality and democracy, which still it excludes. I mean, there is like conditions for you to become part. But for me, I think it relies more on how much we are engaged. It's not like we reduce our political participation in voting every few years. And actually, we're seeing it now. We see a lot of engagement from the younger generation, for the issues related to from the summer of 2015 with the arrival of refugees. I don't like the term, but we use it. Also,
they're white, they're called expats.
Yeah, or immigrants, or travelers. And also with the Friday demonstrations. And so I think there is an engagement, there is worry. We have the worry. And I think that the younger generation is being worried, each in a different way. Mm-hmm. And for me, worry is a sign that there is care. Mm-hmm. But how this care is not being hijacked for the interest of certain groups, because the form of governance we have, it is also responsible for certain people paying taxes and class divisions and privileges, a system of privileges. And this is, we're following Marx's idea. It is it what brought the state or the government to life. There is a connection between this form of governance and capitalism.
Yeah, and I think what we saw in Europe in the last 25, 30 years is a shift from, let's say in the 90s or 80s, a lot of critical thinkers and left-leaning left politicians or intellectuals were extremely against the state. And now this shifted. Now it's the most anti-democratic or the most anti-government movements coming from the right. And
they are louder, not they are stronger, because they are noisy.
Yeah, but it changed somehow that a lot of left intellectuals now actually support the government in a way and would say, I'd rather work for the government than for a big bank or whatever, or for a big company, because the government at least has some checks and balances.
You think we will do that in 20 years, you and me?
Work for a bank? Yeah, of course.
Yes, is it like some? Is it true that we become more conservative with time? Because
maybe it's that, but maybe it really has to do that with the idea that once democracy is established somewhere, it will always be there, and so you can twist and turn and what you see in the United States at the moment. I think even the most right-wing extremist Trump supporters don't think that the democracy is gonna fail, but it actually is a possibility.
Yeah.
If they don't believe in the system anymore, that the system only works if people believe in it, and if there's enough people who don't believe in the system, it will never work again.
And also the distance between these parties, like what is different is like they're becoming, the distance shrinking. Maybe with Sanders it would have been a bit more radical, but it's actually disheartening to see the policies that Obama put in place that we were shocked to realize under Trump, but actually they're Obama. And Obama, who everybody celebrated as the person who's going to save democracy and restore democracy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always the narrative.
There's something. I am not pessimistic, but I might be. Because sometimes it is. I know there's some people have the tendency, like, if we work with the system, we might change it. But I think sometimes it's quite difficult, or even like an illusion. There's an example I always cite, which is the watchtowers that in Palestine, like the Israelis built, and you have Israeli soldiers inside watching the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But if you take the Israeli soldier from inside and you put like a Palestinian revolutionary inside, the tower will continue to produce the same function, which is watching. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like what you do with this structure, how you're gonna
you need to destroy the tower?
Yeah. Actually, I like talking about students and teaching, because I teach in Palestine in the summers until before the pandemic. And there was one student who used to be in prison for 7 years, and he was part of the class, and he chose to kind of examine these towers. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested, like, how, you know, personally, how he will address this issue of tower, of watchtower, and what he gonna do with it. So we all went to the watchtower, and inside this watchtower, it was a crazy experience. So there's inside this watchtower in Al Khalil in Hebron, there are about 4 or 5 soldiers, and we were like around 130 students.
Wow.
and he wanted to bring all the students and use the tower as an example. Of course, it was a frightening experience. I'm like, I'm their teacher, but I decided that day that I'm not going to be responsible. It's them taking responsibility, so I should be one of them. And they all went to the tower and surrounded the tower. And I was like, what will happen? What if the soldiers open fire and we have this situation? And I think everybody was nervous, the soldiers and the students. But the student, what he did with the tower, he turned it into an example and a theater. So he started making fun of the tower and how the soldiers are frightened and how they are frightened. And everybody was laughing, just like exploding in laughter. And for me, I thought, like, okay, we don't have to be in the tower always. We don't have to be in the institution. But we can even change its function by placing ourselves in a different place. So going back to governance and communities, we see a lot of care on a local community level. It's not a replacement for the services of the state, but for instance, in the pandemic, this probably was an important element of society, that the small community that is around you and the care that it can offer you, where people couldn't travel but be in one place. So I'm saying it's not only the state that can take care of us.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to imagine different systems of care.
But it was very interesting also that then now, due to this pandemic, nationalism was back big time as an answer for problems, which was also strange that you say, oh, something bad is happening, let's close the borders, which probably didn't help anything to close borders, but it was almost a reflex that came from another time, in a way.
Yeah, and with the vaccinations as well, like privileging certain nations over others, because this is the one they got the money, and they don't get the money because they are smarter, but they are because they're more exploitative. We know about these structures, how certain countries become rich and others are poor.
Swiss people work so hard. That's why we're so rich.
Yes, yes. Well, we were actually discussing last week in the session we were discussing a text by Angela Davis and about how actually the African Americans, they are the poorest in the U.S. and they are the ones who work the hardest. You know, being enslaved, and being kidnapped from the African continent. So the richness of the country is built or created based on the act of slavery, on this violence, and they are the poorest, and now the kind of the criminal in society, and the one to be excluded.
Well, you talked about that digitalization might undermine the notion of nation. Can you elaborate this a little bit more?
Well, what I meant exactly is that it's undermining the idea of fixed and clear borders, that we don't trespass, that we are remaining in one place, and this is our national landscape. Whereas I think the virtual spaces are allowing actually in one day that we have communication with people who are outside the national border. Because, you know, in terms of community, now we're in this place, the possibility of communication, it happens with the people who are here. But the virtual, you know, we can have it also elsewhere with somebody from a different place. And I think that if here it is contributing because we are having different sensibilities and experiences that they come together, they are not as remote as we might think. You might find a great and coherent connection with an Aboriginal writer from Australia because of the virtual space that otherwise you wouldn't have.
Sie haben auch angesprochen, dass die Italiener Schwierigkeiten haben, dann sich zu integrieren und dann auch assimilieren. Und das macht natürlich das Ganze komplexer, weil ja viele Dialekte in der Schweiz gesprochen werden. Es gibt praktisch keine Schriftdeutsch. Und dieselbe Schwierigkeit finden Sie nicht in Deutschland zum Beispiel oder in die französische Teil, wo man Französisch spricht. Aber die Sprache ist natürlich auch ein Schutzmechanismus für Arbeitsplätze für die Ureinwohner, oder?
Für die Bio-Schweizer.
Natürlich, oder? Ja. Aber Sie haben natürlich Ihre Geschichte auch Teil von Ihrer Herkunft Land, wo Sie ansprechen. Das hat ja natürlich auch mit der Mensch, dass der, wenn der Mensch nicht aus der Falle, damit der Mensch wieder sich erheben kann, muss zuerst ja nach unten fallen. Und das passiert natürlich viel in einer neuen Gesellschaft, oder? Damit dass er sich befreit von seinem ganzen Rucksack und Neues anfangen kann. Und das hat natürlich bei Flüchtlingen, diese Situation ist sehr stark anwesend, oder? Und darum finden Sie den Weg zur Integration dann und Inklusion händler als eine Arbeiter aus dem europäischen Raum. Also ich denke, da liegt natürlich auch ein großer Sinn, warum dass die Leute nicht so schnell sich integrieren lassen. Oder?
Yeah, it's interesting because we were reading and also in the course the text by Hannah Arendt, We Refugees. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, it is not a choice, a free choice that a refugee does. Also we can see it with the case of, in the case of the writer Agota Christoph. There is a part of you that suddenly is being discarded, part of your life, part of your memory, part of the language, and it is something that is a painful experience. I think it is a traumatic experience where also leaving, you want to have a new life. It's almost like a trying to rush to say you are fine, like you are saved. And I think we should be aware of that. This is not a natural or a, how do you say, a healthy way to address that. There is a lot of torment. And I think it's in the text of Agota Christoph, the illiterate, she describes how she arrived in Switzerland with few friends and four of them had committed suicide. It's how to address this pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think also the idea of integration is a very interesting way of thinking when you now think about the maybe antique idea of a nation or whatever, that a nation thinks when new people arrive they have to integrate, but integrate to what? To the language, to the religion, to the political system, or is it just somehow an idea that there are certain things that are, for instance, Swiss and other things are not Swiss or un-Swiss.
Yeah, and actually, the students, it's very interesting because some of the students were bringing this discussion in the class, say, you know, like as if the migrants, they are expected to be Swiss, but we don't know what is Swiss it is.
Exactly,
you know,
what
is a sense, like you eat fondue or raclette, or what is it exactly?
Day, yes.
Actually, I only had it in your party. That was my...
That was my way of integrating you. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, and this is the thing. This demand of integration is not expected from anyone but those. Like, you know, you can be here and nobody asks you, Raphael, can you integrate? And I have to ask you this, integrate with the society and don't be in your solitary ward or garden or whatever you do. But it is a demand that suddenly becomes... directed at a certain segments or groups, but not everybody. Nobody's expected a Swiss, like as if you are integrated into what?
Mm-hmm.
You have the choice of being on your own and rude and you don't want to speak to anybody or just mumble in the street. But as a refugee, it's like as if you are the bad guest.
Yeah, exactly. And that also the idea that there is something to integrate into. Now I thought maybe the word care that you used would actually be a much nicer way to say what actually is meant by integration. Just saying if we're here together, we should care about each other.
Yeah, and to care about each other without, like, you know, this
without
kind of...
forcing something.
Yeah. And without this condescending, like, I care about you because you are weaker.
Mm.
Because
care is
mutual. Mm-hmm. And I think when you are experiencing loss of a place of intimacy, like whatever a place you grow up in, and you feel like you're a burden. And actually, I heard it a lot from Syrians arriving in Germany, and they're saying that they actually get depressed because suddenly they are useless as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They have no role in contributing to the society. They are just being delegated a certain role and certain expectations that this was not the life that they were hoping for. And they would consider going back, although they would be threatened, like as if prison would be easier.
Mm-hmm.
Then you become like a useless person that you have no role.
At one point you talked about nationalism as a narrative with certain functions, a function of security and identity, and you briefly touched on this, what do we integrate to, so what is Swiss, what is German, and I wonder that if you take something from people, so you say, okay, there's no Swiss anymore, like what do you give them instead, what are other narratives you might tell?
Yeah, this is actually the main question, because we are so much used as if this is the only frame for us being together. And it's interesting what else. I think, for instance, now I give you the example of Aboriginal communities in Australia, because I've been like a lot with them and speaking with. And there it's not the idea of an Aboriginal, but it's the idea of nature. It is, and also you find this in communities of the Pacific Islands, that they consider their families, their ancestors, are coming from the ocean. I know you hear that and you think, okay, it is not so rational, but is religion more rational? Like we think of religion and heaven and, you know, all of this creation. I don't think it's more rational than that. And, you know, you sit with some and they tell you, yeah, my ancestors are, you know, shark or whale and so on. And what's interesting in that suddenly when they care about nature, they are caring also about culture. So culture is not dominating nature, but culture and nature, they're together. So when they care about nature, they're caring about their ancestors. And that's why, you know, the nuclear test that that the French governments did in the 50s and the 60s in the ocean, for the people, like in Haiti, for instance, it is an attack on them, and attacking the fishes, attacking them, and the illness that is being felt in the sea, people feel it and experience it even in poetry. So what I'm saying that there are certainly different possibilities. And I think this narrative or this myth of nationalism just limited our understanding of how we can connect with each other. If it's not limiting, if nationalism is something that allows more connections and less violence, I will be for it, but this is what we're experiencing so far, yeah.
And it is also, I think, a weird denominator, the nation as a feeling, because I think if people are really honest, they say, yeah, but before I am Swiss, I am maybe from the Wallis, and that's more important than Switzerland in a way. Or they would say, I'm a person from the mountains, and the mountains are actually more important than Switzerland or whatever. And I think that the being proud of being part of a nation doesn't actually mean the nation in a way. It means also a particular group of people who are proud to be that, you know, but it's not the whole nation that they actually are proud of, because they would be proud of a nation that exists only of people who are proud of the nation, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, and probably yeah. These frames, they become bigger. You're proud from being from the Bernese Oberland, or...
For instance, yeah. Theoretically.
All right. So it's bigger, and I wonder, like, you know, we have probably if we have some other planet, will we suddenly rise and say we are proud to be humans on this earth? And it's always like this sense of togetherness is used to a source of pride, and I think there is a problem of that.
Yeah, why? Because you need also, you always need an enemy in a way. I mean, we would only feel really human if there are aliens attacking us or something. But I mean, in families or small communities, it works well. You can say, yeah, we are all together as a group, and we don't need another group to differentiate us from them, so we like each other more. I think it works.
Or also how we can treat difference as not a threat. I think this is...
Yeah, that would be very important. Yeah.
Because, you know, this frame of nationalism and the idea of a major culture and minorities, it is actually excluding. I would see, you know, sometimes in certain schools, and because I live part of the time in Berlin, and I live on the border of a neighborhood, Wedding and Mitte, so they are exactly the opposite neighborhoods, the working class, the middle upper class. And you see that actually the working class is mainly Turkish, Arab, second generation. But your ethnic background is your destiny, because the schools in Wedding are really terrible. Mm-hmm. Whereas like 1 kilometer away, like the schools are so wonderful and, you know, the best that you can think of. And I think this is the problematics. Like, it's not that there is nationalism, but what the consequences of nationalism, how it's limiting humans' possibilities and dreams and roles in society.
And segregation, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, is it? I mean, I wonder if it's in Switzerland, this is a main question of nationalism. Or is it arising as something that is?
Outside of soccer. well, I think Switzerland has a lot of history to work on, and the self-image of Switzerland is still very strange and has not a lot to do with reality, I think. There's Switzerland, in the end, you know, if everybody lives on a very high level or standard, then you don't need a lot of things like nationalism or religion or
But is it possible for everybody? This is the question. If it's
Of course not. But it's, I mean, Switzerland, let's not fool us, is actually a gated community in a way. Just very big. That's why no one actually feels it. But it's not a normal country on this planet or whatever. It's a very, upper class.
And how is Swiss literature like now? Because I heard that there's like several writers, like Yugoslavian Swiss, or that they are playing.
Well, yeah,
writing,
I mean,
I
then there's the question of language, and I would say to be a writer in different languages is a different job. I think if someone who writes in French has another job than someone who writes in German, because the idea and the notion of what a writer is in every language completely different. I mean, if you're in an Arabic country and you say you're a poet, everybody says, wow, great, you're a poet. And if you're in Germany and you say a poet, people ask you, yeah, but what do you do? You know, and I think I wouldn't say, I mean, the word Swiss literature, I think, is a bit ridiculous, yeah, because I think there's Swiss German literature, there's German literature, there's Italian French literature, and I don't think there's something that we should call Swiss literature, yeah. And what changed, I think a big change for me in the German-speaking literature is that in the 70s and 80s, a lot of writers really thought that Switzerland is not part of the world, or is not participating in the world, and is a boring country where nothing happens. And I think that changed a bit, that now people think, okay, Switzerland also was part of the slave trade, or Switzerland got rich through the wars without participating in the wars. And I mean, even to, it always had a very active role in the world. And that's maybe something that now is more a topic, or Swiss writers also write about going to other countries. Yeah. But it's not a must. I mean, a certain generation, I think, thought they have to leave Switzerland to be able to write, because it's so boring here and nothing happens. Yeah. It's a very important notion that, yeah, a quarter of the people living in Switzerland are not taking part of the political life, or are not allowed to, because they have no Swiss passport, but they pay taxes, and this is also, yeah, this is another example of, but I mean, until the 70s, the women were not allowed to vote also.
Hey, we can always compare it to worse.
which we shouldn't forget, that the idea of democracy in Switzerland is maybe 30, 40 years old, you know. Before it was the good old times, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like a segregation system within the state that is legalized, and it's really,
Which some cities now try to change and say everybody who lives in the city has a right to vote, or, but yeah, we're far from a functioning political system, I think, where everybody is allowed to participate.
And where in other contexts, like, you know, in the context of Palestine, when you have elections and the US doesn't like the results, or the Israeli government doesn't like the results, so it's a problem. Mm-hmm. So it's like always this democracy, if it only is what we expect, and you know, in different situations and countries. And you see that where democratic attempts, they kind of aborted at the beginning. You know, you see like a country like Saudi Arabia, the most terrible dictatorship, and how it's being welcomed and celebrated as a normal member of world politics. And I think the methods used in Saudi Arabia are not much different from ISIS. I mean, it's the same almost structure.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas a country like Iran, for instance, where there is like regular democratic processes and elections, it is the evil. So it's very interesting how this kind of relation to different societies and how we negate them or antagonize them, they're based on self-interest. And
it has more to do with economy, possibly, or with military interests than with the political system. I mean,
And for weapons and the market of weapons, you still would need nations to fight with each other. That's how war is gonna
well,
continue.
You could also have cities or or sports. The other thing, the idea of democracy again. Yeah, another example that I always think is interesting, that we think, South Africa has a democracy, in a way. And then you look at the political process since the end of apartheid, and there's still the same party that rules the country since so-called democracy was established. And it was always a one-party system. But it's called a shining light of democracy compared to the one-party system in China, for instance.
Yes, I wonder of these structures, democratic structures, how much also they exclude, which is a good point that brought, because I also heard this when I arrived in Switzerland about the it was in one of the discussions in the class about certain members of the community, that they cannot be participating based on this element of nationalism, nothing else, and who decides and why. I think it's very interesting to see why nationalism continues, because it serves the interests of certain groups but not everybody, and maybe this is also important to consider, something that is has concern and is concerned with everybody, not certain privileged groups and serving their interests. Yeah. This is the clock now.
Kran. Yes, this is the clock. We are in a watchtower that once was a prison and now has the function of free thinking and talking. So I hope that institutions and buildings can change the use, as also hopefully nations one day will be obsolete. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Demokratie.